customer's ends at 5, so you have time for your sermons.
It's good that you made this nice introduction. So.
Surprise.
Surprise. Just yes. Bishop John.
But we want to get our money.
That's how Bishop John taught me to preach. You know that?
Just call on them.
Yeah. The Lord. It says you're an epistle, but you're preaching now.
I've never had the guts to do that. And I've threatened.
I've done it to Ian. It works.
I was going to do it to Peter Kavanaugh when he was here, but he literally was. I think he would have.
He refused.
Thought, like, yes. No, he wouldn't do it.
He refused.
So.
He's very open.
So Father Ed is a dear friend, and he is, more importantly, the Vicar General of the Western Rite. So he's my immediate boss, and I humbly obey all of his dictates.
The job description doesn't say that. Who knows what communication is going to come in the future.
So
very careful.
Very, very kind and dear friend. And the head of liturgics for the Archdiocese, he teaches at Holy Cross and pastors at St. George in Lawrence. And as more importantly, one of his great accomplishments is he has pastored Ian Abedili.
Since he was just a mite.
Since he was a little baby. And Ian is still in the church after all that, so that's good. Okay, it's an accomplishment. What else to say about you? You want to add anything?
No.
So the schedule is, we're going to have a session now for as long as we want to go. We're not on a really tight, the timeline was a little loose, but you talk as long as you'd like, and then we'll have tea. And we want to thank Melanie, especially. She's not in here. But Melanie and others and somebody. Melanie and somebody. If you don't know who somebody is, somebody could raise your hand. That's somebody. in the Constable home, Melanie is always saying, would somebody do this and would somebody do that? And Subdeacon Jim figured out his name was somebody along the way. So they put the tea together, and we'll have a little refreshment at some point, and we'll come back and have a second session, and then we'll conclude with Vespers somewhere between 5 and 6 in the evening. So we're glad you're here.
Bishop John does a nice talk on men and women in different language they use. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful talk. He touches on that issue.
Oh, somebody.
Wouldn't it be nice if this got done? Well, Ian titled this series Prayer and Fasting, probably because of the season of the year, and it works, you know, because I told him what I planned to talk about was one letter by this medieval English Carthusian, and then a poem. It was written by a Latin writer from what? Fourth century, thereabouts. He lived his life in Spain. And the poem is all about fasting, and the letter is all about prayer. And it comes in that order. And this time of year, people have a tendency to focus on those two things. Not coincidentally, because they think that Lent has something to do with those two things, somehow. And it does, kind of coincidentally. Lent, as it developed in the church, was a means of dealing with the increasing numbers of people that wanted to come into the church, the converts, from paganism, and they developed a systematic way to catechize them. And the whole process took place during these 6 weeks. That most of our Lenten framework comes from the days of the early church when they were catechizing droves of former pagans or people who were raised with nothing, and then baptizing them on either Easter or Pentecost, and then later even Palm Sunday. Squeezing an early class, you know, on Palm Sunday. And the structure of Lent, that we have it, both in the East and the West, it's not different between the East and the West, that basic underlying structure has to come from these people of being baptized. And halfway through Lent, they would hold examinations in the big diocesan centers to determine who was ready to be done at Easter, or who should be held off until Pentecost, which gives you a whole another 6 weeks, you know, to work them in. If they didn't catch you on the first round, you know, they have a whole second round to do it. But this was the main push, was to get it all in at this time and have everybody ready for baptism on Holy Saturday. And the shape of our Easter services, East and West, are all built around the these mass baptisms. And every cathedral church where the bishop sat had a great big baptistry where they would baptize all these people. And you know, the Leaning Tower of Pisa, that's actually a baptistry, and all the old churches had one, kind of just off, outside, freestanding. They make a procession to and from there. And there's the remains of those processions are all there too. So the framework of Great Lent had to do with bringing the catechumens and preparing them for membership in the church, and preparing the church to receive all those new members. Because if you pick in 25, 50, 150 people all at once, you have to be ready to receive them. You have to know who they are, you have to, and you prepare the same way we prepare for anything in the church, you know, by prayer and fasting. And then around the same time, it was the custom to drive out the public penitents from the church services, and they would be given stages. Some of them were hearers, and some of them were kneelers, and some of them had to be outside in the yard, you know. They couldn't come into even into the church during this time of year. And they had to ask everybody that came by to pray for them, that they would be reconciled. And that both of these things fell out of use probably by the 800s. It was a long time ago. Both of these things, but they both left their mark on the church, because it became popular for people, just general folks, to take on the role of penitence during Lent, and to spend this time of year to reconcile ourselves with God, even if we weren't driven out as public penitents in the beginning. And the whole Ash Wednesday scene with the blessed ashes and all of those prayers and those blessings, all of them had to do with the reconciliation of the public penitents. And that rite was only the penitents originally. And then later it was applied to everybody. And when that happened around the 800s, was when people took on the role of penitents. And they began to use this time to think about the relationship with God, and to think about deepening their relationship with God, and using the tools that we always use for those things, and also to heal ourselves of the wounds that we occurred in the year previous. That's a big deal, because we tend to be awfully wounded by the time we get. St. Leo talks about the fasting period is a nice time to wipe off the dust that settles on us from the world. But the world seems to be more than dusty anymore. And I think that we end up pretty much slashed and ground up by the time we get through a year, much more than just having dust fall on us. We're in bad shape. And a bit of this Lent can really serve to heal us. And there's a lot of that in the tradition, because that's the way they talked about the public penitents, and also the way they talked about the catechumens, who had to be healed of their problems. So of the tools that we were given, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, all of them get a big mention during Lent. And so I thought to look at prayer, we would look at this letter on prayer by the author of Cloud of Unknown. We don't know who he was. He didn't have a name. And I forget who it was, one of the famous writers, talking about the very issue, said, well, you know, he's a Carthusian, which means he was a hermit, basically. And hermits usually aren't in the business of self-promotion. And, you know, it doesn't seem to fit. So when he wrote his stuff, generally speaking, as responses to requests to individual people. He wasn't thinking of them being published, although they were published during his lifetime, and he had to put up with a lot of response for a lot of it. He lived at the end of the 1300s, the very beginning of the 1400s, right across the divide there, and that was a bad, it was just picking up from the worst time that the world had seen, you know, the Black Death was in the 1300s, and decimated everything in sight. And that had a big effect on people's spirituality, it had a big effect on people's worldview and the way they responded to each other. And groups like the Carthusians, who were largely hermits, gained some respect during the time of the Black Death because it looked like they were the only ones that knew what was really important. And there's a lot of truth to that, an awful lot of truth to that. In bad times, people do discover how much more important the kingdom of God is than when we're in happy times. You know, somehow it seems that bad circumstances bring out the best in our Christians, and good circumstances are difficult for most of us. So he lived at that time. We don't know his name. We have an idea what his life was like, though. Mostly quiet, praying the services of matins and lauds and the hours and vespers and compline every day. And he was a priest, evidently, so he probably got to serve Mass from time to time. And he wrote a whole series of things on the spiritual life. And he's in the style of St. Dionysius the Areopagite. Well, actually, Pseudo-Dionysius, we say nowadays, but he thought it was the same. Who wrote, might even have been Evagrius himself, you know, that wrote it. It was a Monophysite somewhere along the line that wrote on spirituality and the nature of God and how we come to know God. And Dionysius, wherever he lived, probably in Asia Minor or Palestine even, wrote that we can't know God directly, except by the way he reveals himself to us, because he's a completely other nature, a different, I don't even what kind of word do we use nowadays? I mean, he's a different kind of being who exists in different ways than we exist, so we can't access him, we can't tell always when he's around. We can't tell what he wants. We don't know what he looks like, all that kind of stuff. He's invisible and all of that. And that we can't come to know him through our senses directly is what he taught. But that if we remove ourselves from everything that we know and look at what we don't know, very often God reveals himself to us out of that darkness, as much as we can handle it. And he became hugely popular in the church. 40 years ago when I was in seminary, he wasn't the style, exactly. And Father Meyendorf used to call him the evil genius who perverted the entire church. But he's back up again, I see, nowadays, and people appreciate him again. A lot of these ancient church writers, they are appreciated in cycles. And it happens that in the age that this man was writing, it was a controversy sort of a thing. Do you remember the dates for Gregory Palamas right offhand? He's just like about the same dates, a little after. But he's, I'm not good with numbers. But this guy is beginning in the 1400s, and Gregory Palamas isn't far from there, right about the same time. And he's preaching much the same sort of thing, and he ends up imprisoned for years for preaching this. He ends up becoming a great saint, and his teaching is accepted in the church because he was friends with the emperor. And this particular Carthusian, his teachings were put aside because he was particularly not a friend of the emperor. And politics has a lot to do in the church with what goes up and what goes down and back and forth. So people often wonder about prayer. Why it is that the early fathers, the great church fathers, talk so much about it, like it was such a wonderful thing, and I can't seem to experience that in my life. Why are my prayers so different than the saints' prayers? It seems that if they go on about it so marvelously, especially like Gregory Palamas and others, that there must be something to it. And I feel left out. And a lot of people feel that way. And they start to believe that there isn't really anything to it anyway. That, you know, no matter what you do, your prayers are either going to be rote or they're going to be me talking and nobody answering and kind of dry and empty. And the first thing you should know is that the great saints felt all of that themselves all the time. They didn't find the great and wonderful experiences every day. They happened once or twice a lifetime, and that was enough for them. And the other thing is that when they applied themselves to prayer, they applied themselves, and we tend not to. I don't want to demoralize Father or myself by running a quick tour to see what people's prayer lives are like. It probably upset me too much. But I'm very heartened by the sight of those ordos out there. I mean, somebody follows the daily office, and that's, there's nothing like the daily office. This is where prayer life begins. And I really highly encourage it. Matins and Lauds and Vespers and Compline. Those hours, you know, they're wonderful. And people say, oh, I'm so busy. Yes, exactly, we're so busy. And if we'll take a moment out, instead of running to the water cooler or going for a quick walk, or while we're taking a quick walk and we read the sixth hour, and then sometime in the afternoon we read the ninth hour, before we get home, I think it could make our day so much nicer. And it could, and before we start, you know, if we read the third hour, you know, right before we start work. And I mean, really, they take to read them without seeing them 7 minutes, would you say? You could actually read it while going up in the elevator in some of these office buildings. So we're not talking about a huge investment of time, but the fact that it touches. You touch on these ancient prayers at specific times of the day, and you do it regularly every day, it transforms your whole day. And then, of course, you can read the rest of them at home, and you have all the time in the world. Because if you turn off the television, you do have all the time in the world. Well, nowadays, I understand television's gone, it's the computer thing. The computer tech in my parish doesn't understand why I don't turn it on sleep, I turn it on off. I shut it down. When we're not using it. I don't think it's healthy for it to be playing by itself, and it does, you know. It tells me, oh, I did this while we were away. I don't want to do that. I want it to say, would you like me to do this? But I don't want machines to do things I don't tell them to do. And I'm not checking out that often. So it can run away with it. So somebody wrote to this hermit priest and asked him to tell him about prayer. And he specifically seems to be worrying about his mind wandering at the time of prayer. Now, there's a novel idea. Actually, none of us, our minds never wander during prayer, especially not during church services. And so this guy, somewhere in the 1300s, wonders how he might stop his mind from wandering. And he gets back a letter. And church fathers go, this is a nothing of a letter. It's only 7 pages long. The Ladder of Divine Ascent was written as a letter in response to the exact same question. And it's a great big thick book like this. So So this guy was less wordy, but he cuts to the heart of it, let me tell you. And so he says, with regard to your question, I'm going to read most of this letter to you eventually, because it's just delightful. With regard to your question about how you shall keep your heart during the time of prayer, I answer as best I can out of my frailty. It'll be very profitable to you, I believe, at the very beginning of your prayer, whatever it is to be, long or short, to tell your heart very plainly, without any pretense, that you are going to die at the end of your prayer. And unless you get on with it seriously, even before you come to the end of your prayer. Now that's heavy duty. That will do the job. I can't tell you how many church fathers tell us that the remembrance of death is the most useful thing in the spiritual life. And they say it like that, oh, the remembrance of death. Yes, that's very nice. And some of them put coffins in their rooms and they slept in them and that kind of stuff. But you know, priests don't have to do anything to remember death. We deal with it on a regular basis. There it is, it's all around us. People die. And you know, during the Black Death, people died by the droves. Not that they don't die, they still die. We have too many funerals altogether. People die altogether too much. But to think about death in general, or to think about other people's death, that's much nicer than thinking about your own and thinking it's now. Now this is, it's amazing that he actually said it, and it's the first thing up in the letter. You should think that you are going to die at the end of this prayer, and unless you get on with it seriously, even before you come to the end of the prayer. And realize that what I'm telling you is no mere whimsy, and understand why. For there is no man in this life who would dare to take it upon himself to say the contrary. That is to say, that you will live longer than your prayer lasts. Can I guarantee that I'll live longer? I don't think I can. I can't guarantee I'll live till tonight. Yesterday, there were several occasions when I was in Shredlip till last night. Being on the highway, you know. There's so much that can kill us. In innocuous things, you can die. Well, there's that television show, A Thousand Different Ways to Die. That was a worthwhile show. I don't know if any of you watched it, but it was very interesting to me to see how you could die without even realizing it was coming. Boy. And it happens. You know, we imagine we're going to die in a nursing home, you know, surrounded by our family, at the end of a long life, and all of that. That's an imaginary idea. That's not likely to happen. There are people who make it like that. But if you open the obituary page regularly, at my age I do that. Of course, at my job I do that too, because I want to make sure somebody didn't die and tell me. You discover how many of them die, they're younger than you. And the older I get, the more I see of them that are younger than me. They're dying in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. That is, not to mention the minorities who are dying in their teens and 20s because of the lifestyles that they, you know, they're out there living. We need to be careful with our young people. But really, young people are dying, and they're dying in droves. And middle-aged people are dying in droves. And you don't know if you're going to live. And it would be actually obscene for you to say, I know that I'm going to live till tomorrow. Do you really? I don't think you do. He says then, so it is salutary to think like this, and I advise you to act on it. For if you do, you will see that the consideration of your sinfulness in general, and of the shortness of the time left for amendment in particular, will bring into your heart a truly effective fear. And you shall feel the effect of it hidden deep in your heart, unless, and God forbid, you happen to deceive and beguile your false, carnal, blind heart with lies and false, deceitful promises of a longer life. For though in fact it may be true that you will live longer, it is still a lying falsehood for you to think so beforehand and to promise your heart accordingly. For the truth of it is only in God. In yourself, there is only a blind waiting on his will without any surety with regard to duration. For the reality is as short as the twinkling of an eye or less. And more than a few lengths, I've started out mentioning to my people that before we get to Easter, some of the people sitting in the pews with us are not going to be with us anymore. And we don't know who they're going to be. And it might be me. He didn't give us all of Lent. He gave us just to the end of our prayer. Because he's working on helping people with their prayer. Therefore, if you would pray wisely, as the prophet bids, he's talking about King David in the Psalm, see to it that you obtain at the beginning this truly effective fear. For as the same prophet says in another Psalm, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So he wants a couple of things to happen here at the same time. Excuse me. This developed on the way down to it. I'd like to blame it on my wife because she's sick, but she has so much more than just that, so I might have caught it anywhere. But I'll blame her when I get home anyway. He says that three things have to take place. One, you understand that your life isn't very long. Two, you have to have an idea of how sinful you are. And three, you have to have an idea that that's going to bring some kind of a judgment upon you. None of that goes in a good direction. So in other words, very shortly, perhaps at the end of a half an hour or an hour, you'll find yourself in hell. That's where he's going with this. And I think he did a spectacular job of it. And that's the fear he wants us to have, that left to our own devices, any time now, I'll find myself in hell. And St. Silouan, who's very popular nowadays, that was the advice that he got from John Kronstadt to actually envision the flames of hell leaping about him and realize that he belongs there right now. But only because God is particularly kind that he allows him to live, to even speak about it. And that's exactly what this author, quite a few hundred years earlier, wants us to look at. That we would be in hell at this moment if God didn't graciously give us a little extra time. But we don't know how long that is. So, he goes on, and this is important. Since there is no solid foundation in fear alone, and in case you sink into an unbearable heaviness, you must fasten to the first consideration this second one. Keep it firmly in mind that by the grace of God, you can pronounce distinctly the words of your prayer and come to the end of it. For even if you die before you come to the end, as long as you do all that lies in your power, then your prayer will be received by God in full satisfaction of all your carelessness from the beginning of your life until the present moment. I'm taking it for granted that you will have made the proper amendment guided by your intelligence and your conscience according to the ordinary law of the church in confession. So that was nice that he roots this finally in the sacrament. But he says that this moment of prayer that we're talking about, that we want to offer to God, if we offer it with our full being, with everything we have in it, that can do to wipe out a whole lifetime of sin. He says, as long as you practice regular confession and stuff like that. And he's being very priestly to say that, because we know that the thief on the cross didn't practice regular confession. And he got saved in the twinkling of an eye, right there on the cross. And we can all do that. It can happen for all of us. As long as there is that twinkling, we need to have it. That's why it's better to work on this in advance. This short prayer of yours, little as it is, will be accepted from you by God for your final salvation, even if you were to die in that moment. And if you live longer, for a great increase of perfection. This is the goodness of God, who, as the prophet says, never forsakes those who truly trust in him with a desire for amendment. Now, I'm going to add, we're talking about prayer, and he's talking about prayer. It works for everything. It works for every good thing that you want to do. If you do it with all of your heart, God receives it with all of that emphasis on it, that it's everything. And you've given him everything, even if it's only one thing. And if each and everything that we do in our Christian life, we do as if it was the only one thing we were going to be able to offer to God, then everything we do will be beyond perfect, well, as best as we can do it, and everything will be received by God as perfectly. And that's why I talked earlier when I said that those great saints that talk about finding such great, wonderful experiences, they took it all a little more seriously than we tend to nowadays. We tend to look on most things, you know, this is good enough for government work, and when it comes to the church, see, it's much less than that. Much less than that. This is, we order our lives otherwise, you know. Our jobs usually take precedence over our families, or it's a close tie. And people feel that they're really tugged by their family responsibilities as opposed to their jobs and their careers, pulling them away from their families, and they need to spend time with their families. Where in all of that is their spiritual lives? Where in all of that is their prayer life and the sacraments and all those other things, which, I'm telling you the truth, some moment in your life, in my life, in everybody's life, we're going to come to that point where there is no more job, and there is no more career, and even our family is going to take second place to our preparation to pass on our souls into the hands of God. And I hope that most of us end up with more than a moment's time to make that arrangement with God. We want to, it would be nice if we could work on that all through our lives. It would be very nice, in fact, if the whole focus of our lives had to do with our eternity. And then we'd look at our families a lot differently than we look at them now, and we'd certainly look at our jobs a lot differently than we look at them now. This short prayer is what he says, yes. Since amendment consists of two things, avoiding evil and doing good, there's no readier means of achieving these two than the spiritual exercise in the two reflections mentioned above. For what rids the spirit of sinful inclination more quickly than a right understanding and the fear of death? And what moves the spirit more fervently to good than a sure hope in the mercy and goodness of God, which is brought in by means of that second consideration? That he's caring for us from moment to moment, that he gives us extra time, that he helps us in every good deed that we want to do, and that he receives every good deed that we do as a perfect thing, covering our whole lives. This is really tremendous. And he says, when the spiritual feeling born of this second reflection is properly related to that of the first, it will be for you a sure staff of hope to support you in all your good deeds. With this staff, you may safely climb the high mountain of perfection, which is to say perfect love of God, even though its beginning is imperfect, as you shall hear later on. For though the general understanding that you have of mercy and goodness of God, along with his general awareness that you feel of his mercy and goodness, that is his acceptance of this little and short service, for such long negligence and full satisfaction for so much carelessness is impossible, you should not feel a great stirring of love for him who is so good and merciful towards you. The steps you take with your staff of hope will clearly show you during your prayer if you carry it out in the way I've explained to you before. And there's the whole thing. That's all he has to say, really. He's going to play around with it a little bit further, but that's the whole thing. That if you approach God with your whole being for any short stretch of time, but really with your whole being, God receives that offering to him as being of total worth. Total worth. Most of the saints didn't live their entire lives as an offering to God. They lived moment to moment as an offering to God, and it just happened to build up into a lifetime. But it wasn't the plan in the beginning, because we can't plan that sort of thing out. We don't walk that way either. We walk one step at a time. You can't walk from here to the store. all at once. The teletransporting and stuff like that. It doesn't work physically and it doesn't work spiritually. You don't get from here to there unless you take a bunch of steps. And a life lived in God is a life lived in little steps. And what this man wants us to see is that each step needs to be carefully perfected for the whole thing to be perfect. So he's looking at those little steps and showing us how to make them most effective. Human beings, when they walk, don't think about it, generally, unless they have a problem. You know, if they've hurt their knee, they hurt their ankle, they hurt their back, or they're old, they think of every step they take, and they want to make sure that it's placed right. They want to make sure that they're not going to slip and fall. You know, my mother, when she was around 90, she's 92 now, she doesn't walk much anymore. But when she was still walking, even on a walker, she made a big deal about each step she took. She felt she could fall any minute. So each one was placed carefully. And if you've seen people who've hurt their backs, they do the same thing, because it takes on a more feeling than it does when you're healthy and you do it without thinking. You just walk away. And that's what we've been doing with our prayer. We just walk away without thinking about it. And we are probably more crippled and disabled than we know spiritually. So we need these kind of exercises to focus us on what we're supposed to be doing. The next thing up that he says is that what you're hoping to achieve by all of this is something that he calls reverence. Which he says, reverence is nothing else but the mingling of fear and love, along with that staff of certain hope. So that the coming together of these three things, that fear of the judgment being immediately impending, the relief that God will receive even this moment of real concentration on him to make what we're doing, and that, by the way, is what he calls repentance too. This focus. And then this causes us to love God, and that when you put that fear and that relief and hope with the love which comes up, he calls that connection reverence. And he says that reverence and devotion, things are the same thing. He says the readiness of man's will to do what belongs to the service of God. And that this is Thomas Aquinas' definition of this. And he throws it in there just to show that he read that. I don't think it's particularly helpful. And he says, let each man take the measure of this in himself. For he that serves God in this way knows by experience how prompt his will for it. Everything that we do for God should be done swiftly and gladly. Swiftly out of fear, and gladly because of hope and loving trust. You see. So he brings this together for this. And he goes on, probably a bit in too much, trying to get some of this across, but he says some interesting things along the way. He said, I would sooner have the reward of the man who has persevered in this work, though he never did any bodily penances in his life, except that which is enjoined by Holy Church, than the reward of all those who from the beginning of the world to the present day have concentrated on doing penance, but without the experience of this kind of exercise. I'm not saying that simple reflection on these two considerations is so profitable, but that they are various special means on man's part for obtaining that reverent affection. This, I say, is what is so profitable. This is the only exercise, independently of any others, such as fasting, keeping vigil, wearing hair cloth, and all the rest, which is of itself pleasing to Almighty God and deserves to have his reward. It would be impossible for a soul to have God's reward without this reverent affection, and the reward shall be in proportion to it. For he who has much of it shall have a great reward, and he who has less of it shall have less. All these other things, like fasting, keeping vigil, wearing hair's cloth, and so on, are profitable only insofar as they are helpful in obtaining this reverent affection. Without it, they are nothing, while reverent affection is sometimes completely sufficient in itself without these other things. And this is so important to us in our spiritual lives to understand that the tools that God gave us aren't the means, aren't the ends in themselves. They're only the means. Tools are tools. They're exactly that. We don't fall in love with the tools. We don't worship the tools. It's the end of it. The end of it is God. What we're supposed to bring to God is our reverent affection, our love for God, pure love of God. He created us only to share his love with us. Not that he could have a bunch of little robots that he wound up, and they go about doing these penitential things without any profit in them, without any profit in them at all. And when people approach Lent, they approach it that way. Oh my gosh, how am I possibly going to do all this? All those extra Lent services, and that Lent fasting, and then they have those food for hungry boxes on top of it. And this is all too much for me, and I hate Lent, and I wish it would go away. And one of my spiritual children constantly asked, why are there so many pink days on the calendar? There have to be so many pink days on the calendar, because the Vestal calendars, they're all in pink, the fasting days. Should I count them every year to see how much portion of the year it makes up in pink days? This is sad. This is sick, too. I don't count very well, so I can't do it. Maybe I'm lucky. But I can't count and see how many pink days there are. But the reason people get upset about Lent is because it looks like so much work with no return. I do all these things every year and there's nothing coming back for it. Because we do them as things in and of themselves, because we're told to do them. Well, I'm told I'm supposed to fast this way, so I'll fast this way, and this is really difficult. And I'm told I should go to church more during Lent, and they have all those extra services, so I'll do that. And I don't care for it, but there I am, you know. Well, if you approach it in that way, you're not going to, really? How are you going to get anything out of it? Nothing comes out that way from anything we do in this life. If that's the way you practice the violin, you're certainly not going to be on stage anytime soon. Because if you go about it, oh, I have to do this, my mom said I have to practice, and just scrape it away. You're just not going to get there. It's not going to happen. You have to enter into it with a different mindset that I'm practicing for a reason. I'm doing this because there's a goal. And what I want to get out of it is what I'm looking for. And he tells you how to put something into it. So for very many people, the spiritual exercises of Lent seems to consist in these the physical acts of penance. And they haven't found the spiritual underpinning, which is what brings joy and happiness. And he says, therefore I shall say a little more than I have yet said about the merit and worth of this reverent affection, in the hope that through my exposition you may be better instructed in this exercise than you are at present. He says, the nature of the aforesaid exercise in this reverent affection, when it is introduced by these two reflections on fear and hope, now remember, you've got the whole thing, you know, fear of judgment now, and hope because God is good and receives our repentance, what we're offering him completely, may well be compared with a tree that's laden with fruit. Fear is the part of the tree which is within the earth, that is the root. And hope is the part of the tree which is above the earth, that is the trunk and the boughs. Inasmuch as the hope is sure and stable, it resembles the trunk. Inasmuch as it draws men to works of love, it resembles the boughs. But this reverent affection is always the fruit. As long as the fruit is hanging on the tree, it shares in some way the unripe savor of the tree. But sometime after it is plucked from the tree and is fully ripe, then it loses all taste of the tree. Before it was fit only for servants, now it's fit for the king. It is at this time that this reverent affection is profitable, as I said. So set yourself to gather this fruit from the tree and offer it, as it is, to the high King of heaven. See, what we're offering to God isn't even the prayer, but it's our reverent affection, our love for God that we're offering to him by means of this prayer. That's what he wants you to see. Don't offer God the tree. Offer God the fruits of the tree. Don't give God the tools that he gave you. Give him the results. Give God the love that he wants from us. And we use the prayer to carry this love to him. That's always the fruit. Always. It is at this time. Yes, and you should, yes. Oh, yes. It says, you offer this to the high King of heaven, and you shall be called God's own child, loving him with a pure love for himself and not for his gifts. This is a big deal. What I mean is this. Innumerable good gifts, which the Almighty God has given to every soul in this life, are wholly sufficient reasons and more for every soul to love him with all its mind and all its understanding and all its will. Yet if it were possible, which it's not, for a soul to be as powerful, worthy, and intelligent as all the saints and angels in heaven taken together, and not to have received its worthiness from God, nor to have been shown any kindness by God in this life, if such a soul saw the loveliness of God in himself and the abundance of it, it would be ravished above its powers to love God until its heart burst. So lovable and so attractive, so good and so glorious is he in himself. Oh, what a wonderful thing, and how high a thing to speak of, is the love of God and beyond the comprehension of man. In such wise that no man can speak of it so as to give the right understanding of the least degree of it, except by impossible examples. That was very thick, and it came kind of fast. I'm going to go through it again. You have to parse it out. He said, if it were possible for a soul to be as holy as all the saints and angels taken together, and even at that point had never received anything from God, no gifts to make him want to love God, which is just not possible, but if, just imagine it could be possible, that such a holy soul, completely open to God and able to see him, who had not received from God any gifts, but was able all of a sudden to see God in all of his loveliness and his beauty, he would be, this particular soul, be so ravished above its powers to love that its heart would burst. This is how lovable and attractive, good and glorious God is in himself. You know, very often we love God when he does good things to us. And very often, and it's a great sadness to the clergy, when we see people hate God because they didn't get what they were looking for from God. And then they end up hating God and hating the church, and hating the priest very often. And they withdraw from the church. It isn't productive to behave in this fashion. It's more than counterproductive. But we do it all the time. We judge God by what we receive or don't receive from him. And what this priest wants us to look at is not what God gives us or doesn't give us, but what is God in and of himself? Not even who, but what is God in and of himself? His very self. And a great church writer a little before him, right around the year 1000, in Constantinople, Simeon the New Theologian, spent most of his life trying to make people to understand this one point. How adorable God is in and of himself, that love of God for who he is can in and of itself transform us completely and in an instant because of how beautiful and wonderful God is. And all the saints at some time managed to say, in one way or another, that if we were to come, if we were to be given the experience of God as he is, everything in this world would be meaningless, worthless, and useless to us because we wouldn't be able to take our minds off of the beautiful thing that we just saw. So, in that sense, God is certainly more powerful than crap. And that's exactly what the saints want us to understand. You know, we know of addicts who find that the substances are more worth to them than life itself. They will not eat. They will live in squalor. They will share their life with bugs. They will do anything to have more of what they just got. And the great saints often forgot to eat, and they lived very poorly, if not in squalor. And they shared their life with bugs because they wanted to spend time with God and not on the things of this world. And the people in this world say they're crazy. But it's not that they're crazy. They have experienced something so much more worthwhile than all of this that they can't turn away from that for this. And it changes their lives completely. It has to transform their lives 100%. And we judge the addicts because they're withdrawn from the world to focus themselves on the life of the drug of their choice. They're no longer profitable members of society. And I think sometimes it's worthwhile comparing the judgment against monastics, that they've run away from society and not profitable society, because they've chosen to look at something else. And I think on the part of the world, it's the same response, that we see it as so negative because it isn't helping us to make this world run the way it has to run. And everybody has to be a part. And that's what city life is all about. That's why people come together in cities, so that they can share life together and make it easy for everybody. It's also why the early Jews had such a fear of cities, because they require us 100% into something that isn't God. And civic life, the way that Greek philosophers talked about it, and the way they even teach about it in school, is a responsibility that takes us away from God, on the bottom line. And I think at some point you have to make a choice. And this man was a hermit. He made a choice. So his speech about these sort of things will be colored by his choice that he made, and not ridiculously, I would have to say. 2:30, right? So, this is the most important thing that he wants people to discover, is that God is so lovable in and of himself that irregardless of whether we receive a gift from him or we don't, we can't help ourselves loving him to the point that we are, we're changed and completely focused on him. He says that if, let me read this paragraph, because his words are better than mine. As therefore, in the language of my parable, set yourself to pluck the fruit from the tree and offer it alone to the King of Heaven, that is, your love, your reverent affection, so that your love will be chaste. For as long as you offer him the fruit while it is still unripe and hanging on the tree, you may well be compared to a woman who is not chaste, because she loves a man more for his gifts than for himself. See then why I make this comparison. I believe that it is your fear of death and of the shortness of time, together with hope of forgiveness for all your carelessness, that makes you as reverent as you are in God's service. If this is how it is, then your fruit has the unripe savor of the tree. And though it pleases God up to a point, it does not please him perfectly. And this is the reason why your love is not chaste. Chaste love is when you ask God neither to be freed from pain, nor to have increase in reward, nor for the sweetness of his love in this life, unless it be at any given time that you desire the sweetness for the restoring of your spiritual strength, so it does not fail you along the way. It is when you ask God for nothing but himself, and you do not care or take account of whether you are in pain or in bliss, as long as you have him whom you love. And this is chaste love, this is perfect love. Therefore set yourself to pluck the fruit from the tree. That is, pluck your reverent affection from the thoughts of fear and of hope which come before, so that you can offer it in itself to God ripe and chaste, having as its source nothing that is beneath him nor mingled with him. Though it were the best of these, but him alone, by himself. Then is it as rewarding as I say it is. Then it is rewarding as I say it is. And until then, it isn't, you see. And we struggle, and we flail about, and we beat the air, and thrash about, and we don't get there. And here is pretty close to the beginning for him. He got there right away. And we spend a whole lifetime, we don't get there. Because we're not focused like we need to be. He says that we need to separate our love for God from what got us there. That fear and the hope that he would forgive us. But when that brings about love for God, we let the fear go and we let the hope go and we focus on the love of God. And it becomes for us by itself the motivation for everything that follows. And we no longer, remember, fear is the beginning of the love of God, it says in the scriptures, it says that. And yet, it also says perfect love casts out fear. And that's the way it is in the spiritual life. If we move from the fear and the hope to the love, right in the bat, the first couple of times, move there, and focus there, stay there. Don't let ourselves waver from there. Unless we happen to fall, then you climb back in the same way. But those move us directly to love of God. And so then, the only reason we pray is to spend time with God, that we love him so much, to offer him these moments of our lives, just because we love to spend time with him. And then we can ask him to give us prayer as a gift. You know, the time of prayer is a gift. Oh, I can't work it into my schedule. I always tell people, then ask God. Sit down and pray about that. Ask God what time would be best for me to pray to you. And he gives you the answer. You find the spot where it works. Because he understands that you came to him because it's him you desire. And that you're trying. He understands. He knows. You don't have to explain it to him. It's not 20 questions. God understands intuitively everything that we think. All of this is for us to understand what we need to do. God, he understands. And he knows his part too. And he does it even before we ask. And it's marvelous and wonderful. He says, and when in the first beginning you feel this exercise to be so hard, heart-constricting, without consolation, this means that the greenness of the fruit is still hanging on the tree, or else just plucked, it puts your teeth on edge. Nevertheless, it is profitable for you. For there is no way of eating the sweet kernel without first cracking the hard shell and biting the bitter rind. However, if your teeth are weak, if your spiritual strength, which is your spiritual strength, then my counsel is that you have recourse to stratagems, for skill is better than brute strength. He says, there's another reason I'm planting this tree in your garden for you to climb. For although God can do whatever he will, yet as I understand it, it is impossible for any man to attain to the perfection of this exercise without these two means or others like them coming before. And yet it belongs to the perfection of this exercise to be sudden and without any means. That's important. To be sudden and without any means. And therefore I counsel you to make these considerations your own, not yours by right, or to think that it would be sinful, or to think that would be sinful, but yours is a gracious gift of God, sent by me as his messenger and worthy though I am. For you must understand full well that every thought that moves you to good, whether it comes from within, as an angel messenger, or without, by a human messenger, it's simply an instrument of grace given and sent and chosen by God himself to work within your soul. That's marvelous, you know, all just by itself, just too wonderful. Just too wonderful. God acts on us by all sorts of means. And we cannot act on God by any means. He's beyond our acting. We can act on ourselves. And we come before God, and he acts on us. And all of the fathers agree this is very important, that God chooses the moment to come and reveal himself to us. We can't bring this on. We can make ourselves ready for it. We can be open, but we can't make it happen. Only God can make it happen, and he does it at the moment that he thinks is right. How often is an inconvenient moment for us? This is without saying. The moments God chooses to reveal himself to us has nothing to do with how we imagine we want to spend, you know, go about the things in our lives. He, at the moment that's right for him, means it's sudden for us. And we, being humans, act a lot like Pavlov's dogs. And this happens to us all the time, that if we were doing this particular thing at the moment God came and blessed us, we think we should keep doing that particular thing because it brought God to bless us. And you find people doing this in their spiritual lives all the time. All the time. And that includes Saint Silouan, his disciple Sophroni, who happened to be saying the Trisagion, holy God, holy mighty, when the grace of God fell upon him once, and he connected the two in his mind, and he was convinced that because he was saying holy God, holy mighty, God came to him and it led him down a blind stairway, is what it did, because it had nothing to do with it. God acts on his own. And he can't be controlled that way. That becomes magic, you see. If a particular incantation can cause God to do a particular thing, this is magic. We don't worship that kind of a God. In fact, we fight against people who worship those kinds of gods. Those are demons that act that way. Our God does not. Ours is the one who says, you know, the spirit bloweth where it listeth. And you don't even know where it comes from or where it's going to. It passes by you today. And you appreciate it. And you love it. You can't help it. You love who God is when he comes by, and because one of the things that everybody notices is that God loves us before we love him, and he loves us more than we love him, and he knows us intimately, so that when these moments happen, when we find ourselves in the presence of God, the first thing we discover is that this is not a momentary event, but that this is the momentary noticing of what is a lifelong event. That God loves us every moment of our lives, whether they're long or short, and that love for us is beyond description and infinitely more bountiful than we can imagine, and that we can't help ourselves but respond with loving him. We can't stay in that moment all the time. We would be exhausted. We'd die. We'd just be ravished out of ourselves and die. That's happened to people. The lives of saints are full of it. There's one poor guy that went to see all the holy places at the Mount of the Ascension. He just was so taken up and died. He just died. And that happens. And it's not a tragedy. It's neither here nor there. But it's we can't live like that. If we live like that, we die. That's what happens. So that may not be bad to go and be with God all the time. And that might be marvelous, but as human beings, we can't live that way. So we only approach these moments from time to time in our lives, special moments from time to time. We can't expect them all the time because they kill us, honestly. They kill us. It's like going up you know, going up onto the mountain with Moses, and he wouldn't let them come. He said, don't touch the mountain, it'll kill you. Moses was protected by God so that he could do that. And we have Elijah, who wanted to see God. He was only allowed to see the backside from a distance, because to see the front side would kill him. We really want, once you get involved with all this, you really want to see it all. And God has to keep reminding us, no, 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 no. It's too much for you. It'll kill you. The day is coming when you can see directly. But now, we see darkly as in a mirror. That's what St. Paul said. And that was on purpose. 2:30, you said. 15 minutes for comments, discussions, questions. That was spectacular. Comments, nothing. I don't believe it. Now, don't wait till we get outside and we're having tea to have the comments. Let's have it now. He says, when we speak of ordinary perfection, the great goodness and the great kindness that God has shown us in this life are noble and worthy reasons for loving God. Yet the perfect lover of God who directs his gaze at the bullseye in the target of perfection, and it is toward this that I intend to direct you by writing to you in these terms, for fear of missing his perfection, that is to say, its supreme point, now seeks no other reason for loving God except God himself. And this is what I mean when I say that pure love is to love God for himself and not for his gifts. This is the point of the whole thing. This is what he wants people to understand. But the tool that he used to get there, the fear, that is the beginning of wisdom, as the scripture says, he tells us how to get there pretty quickly. I mean, the first time I read this, it took my breath away to say, I will die before the end of this prayer. So I better make this count. I mean, this is a problem. That's a big deal. Yes, sir.
Father. Yeah, I thought that was a great point and a great point of emphasis for our prayers, because, you know, I've often found, and I don't know if I'm speaking just by on behalf of myself, but my thoughts tend to wander more when you're in prayer than what you would be like if you were watching a TV program. You're pretty much set. Your thoughts are, you know, you're fixated, but once you get into prayer, all these random thoughts just start coming into your head. Mm-hmm. But that is a great way of putting it in the importance of your prayer.
Yeah, you'll get rid of the thoughts. I had cancer about 6 years ago, and when we were done with the testing and leading up to all the surgery and all that kind of stuff, I think my whole prayer life was a bit more exciting than it was before that. I'm quite sure that it was, and everything changed a lot at that point. As we moved towards the day of the surgery and then the recovery after that, I had a very different take on not only on prayer, but what was important, what needs to be done in this life. And I thought of my dad. My dad had cancer, and he knew in advance that they weren't going to do anything about it. So he set everything in order. He went through the house while he still had the strength and cleaned everything out. He didn't even tell my mother he was doing it. He visited funeral homes to see which one he liked better. He visited during wakes, other people's wakes. He didn't know who they were, just to see how they did. And then he wrote up what he wanted done for him and who he wanted to have do it. And he spent months preparing for his own death in very practical ways, really, which is what he, men of his generation were like that. They were in charge and had to take charge of his had everything done and done the way he wanted it. Towards the end, we had to change his mind on a couple items. He decided how he was disposing of my mother and her sister and all this other stuff without asking them. He was going to put my aunt in a nursing home. He was going to put my mother in a senior housing complex. He was going to sell the house, do all this kind of stuff. We finally had to say, let's slow down. And they have their opinions. But he set himself to do what he thought needed to be done in light of the fact that he was not going to be around much longer. And everything he did was with a very strong strong purpose. Even the visits of his pastor when he came to the house, they were different than they had been, you know, before when the pastor came by. These were elevated because in the light of where he saw he was going and where what was meaningful at the moment wasn't what was meaningful before. And I promise you, when the pastor used to visit before, they'd have a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, and make small talk, you know, talk about the weather and the kids and stuff like that. And there was none of that when the pastor came to see him the last couple of times. He wanted the sacrament. He wanted him to read the prayers for the sick and the dying and all that kind of stuff. He wanted to do his job, his actual sacramental job. He didn't want him just to be visiting as a friend. He wanted what he represented as the church. And that that showed the change in his in the direction in what was important to him. His priorities changed very clearly. And, you know, you hear that story from everybody that has a brush with death, but you don't have to have such an extreme event in your life to get that kind of reward. And that's what this author wants us to see, that it's ours for the grabbing just by the mere notice that we are really very frail and very mortal right now, without having COPD or cancer or high blood pressure or heart disease or God knows what, that we pound at home. When my home priest had a valve replacement, he said, I hear it ticking all the time, the artificial valve, it's ticking my life away. This is the way he thought of it. He's still alive. We had that done in 1984. And it was ticking his life away. He's still ticking away. He's 96 now, I think. The oldest serving priest in the archdiocese. The oldest priest in the archdiocese, not serving. His heart valve is ticking his life away. But you don't have to be there. You can, this man, nailed it right from the beginning. Here I am at this church service. Here I am at this, at my morning prayers. Here I am at my evening prayers. Here I am at whatever I'm doing for God. And I am going to die by the time I finish this. So how am I going to do this thing in light of that fact? And ta-da, it does the job. But you have to move on from there. You can't leave it there. You have to move on. And he makes that point spectacularly. Otherwise, it's green and doesn't taste right yet. You have to pluck it from the tree and let it ripen. 5 minutes left. And the ladies have control of this stuff.
And I really like what I'm saying. I think for me, it's kind of given me a new perspective about what it means to live in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
I've always thought living in the moment, it's a nice kind of bromide.
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds like living in the moment without care for the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't sound like that's what he's saying. It's you live in the moment because you care for the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it changes the whole way one lives in each moment.
It changes your care for the future. The future means something different. Something more worthwhile, something deeper, something. You can't be shallow and practice this. You can't. In anything in your life, you just can't be. Yeah. I hesitate to say even your job. I said a lot of bad things about jobs. I say, why do you hate it? You know, the teaching of the apostles in the Scalia Apostolorum, which is 3rd century, 4th century, 4th century, yeah? They remind the bishops teach your people that what they do for a living is only on the side. That it's their life in the church that's the most important thing that they do. And that what they do else is, you know, that's it's so they have enough to be able to give something to the poor people around them. And that's it. It isn't the point of our lives. You know. Read those obituaries and see where people go with it nowadays. It's sad, you know. Oh, you know, his career meant so much to him, and he put all his life in his career and in his family. It's probably not right. And it probably doesn't produce in the end anything worth having. I'm with this marvelous Carthusian. I wish I knew his name. Everybody does. The books on his life, on these works, always say that the biggest mystery is who wrote this stuff. And when you have this many works by an anonymous author, and tie them all together, even put dates on them, and don't know who he is, it's very frustrating. It'd be a lot more fun to have a life. He wouldn't have been a Carthusian hermit then, if he wrote his autobiography. Bizarre.